This is WGXC. This is George Spencer. It's Art, Etc. I have a very interesting person here that I'm going to be talking with in a minute, but I wanted to say a couple of things first. The show's been on for about a year, and one of the things that I'm interested in doing is finding some writers, poets, fiction writers, whatever, perhaps critics, not necessarily people with an academic background, that have a particular interest in a period of literature or particular writers. And I'm thinking of someone like Beckett or James Joyce or Gerard Manley Hopkins, something of that sort. And anybody who has any interest in that or knows of somebody who would be can get hold of us at 518-697-7400 or at info@wgxc.org. I'd like to build a program around one or two writers or periods or something of that sort, which I think would be sort of interesting. Today, I'm very fortunate to have Robert Godfrey here with me. He's a artist who's lived in Hudson now since,
2011,
and has been around and done a lot of very interesting things. And I wanted to start by saying thank you for coming in, first of all.
Okay, likewise. I appreciate the invitation and glad to be here, George.
That's great. That's great. And it is such an incredibly beautiful day. We should somehow or other find a way to do this outside. But I'll tell you what I wanted to start out by asking you is that you use some fairly unusual supports for the artwork that you do, and you also use some fairly not common, I guess would be a better way to put it, materials to make images. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that. And the reason I'm asking you that, by the way, this is quite self-serving, because I want to find out about the longevity of the paint you're using and how you make sure it adheres to the supports that you use.
Well, whatever I'm using is going to outlast me, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Basically, the material that I'm using evolved out of using more traditional materials. The first 35, 40 years that I painted, I'm mainly using aluminum panel, which is an interior-exterior material used with graphic designers, sign designers, etc. And the material.
And this is for exteriors.
It can be either way, and it's very flat. Mm-hmm. It doesn't wrinkle like rabbit skin glue or white lead on linen. Mm-hmm. It's not forgiving when you touch it. So things like spray paint and things like that become very conducive to moving paint around on a surface. Mm-hmm. The reason I shifted to aluminum, one, it's lightweight. Secondly, it's very accessible and. The material that I'm using is as durable, or if not more durable, than your basic so-called fine art paints. Interior, exterior, UVH protected, and things such as that.
Now, if you go out and buy a piece of aluminum that's 4 feet by 6 feet, what's that going to cost you? I mean, relatively compared to say getting a piece of wood you could paint on or a canvas.
I was using Belgian linen for a long time, and it's very, very expensive, maybe $30 to $50 a yard or when I left it and 15 years ago. The aluminum, which is a panel, it has a corrugated center, so it's not flexible, doesn't bend. I'm trying to think. You buy them in 4 by 8 foot sheets, and they're probably about $100, but you can go higher than that if you want. And for me, I'm using a type of paint where I don't have to prepare anything, and I'm using a raw side. I'm not using an enamel side, which sign painters or sign graphic people would work on silkscreen people. But yeah, I never quite worry about the cost of anything. It's what I need to do to get something done.
To get to where you want to get to. Yeah. And then the medium that you use.
Oh, you mean like the spray paint, the industrial paint,
yeah,
the commercial paint?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all top line, so to speak. I mean, I can get it at Lowe's or I can send for it. I use industrial markers also that are much more durable than your oil stick, your fine art oil stick. And I just find that it's more durable. I don't recommend it for everybody. I don't know. Perhaps it should be included in a materials and technique class in art school. I don't know.
Is it hard to manipulate any of these things you're using?
Well, it's not like oil paint. It's going to dry very
very quickly.
Very quickly, depending if you're pouring it and you're using a industrial enamel or something like that. Yes, it may take a week or two before I can work an image over it. I don't know if that's answering your question
yes,
or not.
Yeah, very much. Was there any particular, aesthetic reason or artistic reason or philosophical reason why you started?
No, I just mess around.
But you've been using this for a long time, right?
Yeah, you start off slow, and then you can see how much you can get away with me. And it's just messing around in the studio, like I messed around with different oil pigments, different media, and stuff like that. It's just something I'm playing around with.
Do you have anything else in terms of that you're thinking about using in terms of medium or supports?
No,
or?
I'm not a person who plans. I just, if something comes up and something hits me, if I'm walking somewhere, I see something, I say, oh, that might be interesting to try. I mean, I was trained in the ABCs of art, and I didn't follow the rules very well, and I don't follow any rules. In terms of you mentioned longevity and all that, I figure if a house paint you can slap that on and it'll last 20, 30 years outside without fading. It's good enough for what I'm doing. And
yeah, that was the only question I had because
yeah.
I actually went to the paint store yesterday and I had a long conversation with the paint guy there. And sort of what he was sort of telling me was that he doesn't know much about, artistic acrylic and that kind of thing. But he did seem to think that the colors didn't have the covering power that you would get from a high end acrylic.
I have no comment on that. If I'm writing, if a felt tip pen works, that's fine. If a ballpoint pen works, that's fine. Other people, I never really worked in fine art acrylic that much, so to speak. And I'm getting the brilliance that I need.
So let's just maybe go back to the beginning. So you grew up in a farm, right, in New Jersey?
Yeah, I grew up in southern New Jersey, a little community called Mount Laurel. I was born before Pearl Harbor was bombed, so it goes back a long time ago. And it was a community of about 800. It was great farming land, basically developed in the 1600s, 1700s by the Quakers, and then stayed a farmland until we all knew when the Jersey Turnpike was built in the 50s that was probably going to be the end of farming.
Oh, is there a Mount Laurel exit?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, that's right. I remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
There wasn't the first 13 or 14 years of my life. But that's now, I think, about a 50,000 population with a lot of usual things. Very few farms are left. Most of my relatives who stayed in farming went to either Delaware or to Eastern Shore of Maryland. Way back in the 1960s is when things started moving out.
So you went to school there?
Yeah, I went to school in southern Jersey.
And so you Was it your maternal grandmother was a Quaker? Is that
my maternal great grandmother?
Great grandmother.
My grandfather's mother, and we did not know that growing up.
Oh, really?
No, it was never mentioned. I met a lot of people. My grandfather took me around in his pickup when I was very young. One of our neighbors were the Paul family. That was a Quaker family. Alice Paul was the one who wrote the Equal Rights Amendment that Eisenhower finally passed.
Oh, really?
Her brother, Billy, operated the family farm. And I met Billy through my grandfather. That was all just fascinating. I had to put it into context many, many years later. In terms of that.
Did any of the sort of Quaker ideas filter their way down to you?
It's very interesting, George, because very few of us were ever involved with... my father was a veteran, but he's the only one that I know in the whole family in terms of the Quaker pacifism. But as I said, it was never mentioned. I came across recently a high school paper I wrote on what I expect from the future, and it was anti-war, which I can't believe that I wrote that. And so if it filtered down, it's either in the genes or just a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes things filter down that aren't talked about in the sense that there may not be a lot of talk about war and violence, and you begin to think that's the way things should be.
Well, it's interesting. The folkloric, and I can't find it in writing, my great-grandmother, grandfather, established an integrated school in Mount Laurel. And I...
When was this?
This would have been in the late 19th century.
So that was...
My grandfather, their children all went there, and I verified it with an elderly black man when I was older named Windy Gaines, and he says, yes, indeed, your grandfather and I were classmates. That school system was segregated later on, and my father went to a segregated school in Mount Laurel. But for a while, it was an integrated school started by the Quakers. The other thing that's very interesting, Mount Laurel was a huge railroad underground.
I didn't know that.
And what people don't know is that...
So they must have connected and gone up the Hudson, do you suppose, to Canada?
Well, that whole area of Burlington County was a huge Quaker area. It was eventually called West Jersey, and the governor was William Penn.
Oh, okay.
And at the time, he was developing Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Jersey was either West Jersey or East Jersey. It wasn't New Jersey in the 1650s or et cetera. So anyway, just a bit of history.
Yeah, so it sounds like, these sort of Quaker ideas of conscience and spirit and whatnot sort of permeated somehow.
So somewhere along the way. I mean, I might call it entanglement. I don't know what I call it. But it took me years to try to sort some of that stuff out.
Sort some of it out in what sense?
What's that?
And you sort it out in what sense?
Exactly what I was experiencing without knowing what I was experiencing.
Ah, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. No, it makes perfect sense. So, anybody in your family an artist? How did it happen that you became?
Well, that's a very, very long story. Let's just say that I was, some people were born with silver spoons. I was born with I was given a ladder that didn't have many wrongs, so I had to create my own wrongs.
Uh-huh.
I was the first one to, first male in the family to ever graduate from high school.
Really?
I was the first one, obviously, born in a hospital. And as I said, I was born in 1941, and it was only 4 years before that the farmhouse had electricity. We finally got indoor plumbing. Nobody knew how to put in a bathroom, and we used an outhouse. So it was an interesting quick climb, and I eventually went to art school in Philadelphia. Architecture was something that I really loved.
When you say did you go to art school as college, or you went? Okay, where did you go?
It was then Philadelphia Museum School of the Art, and then became Philadelphia College of Art. It's now University of the Arts.
Was this where Aikens taught before they threw him out?
No, that was the Academy.
Oh, okay.
And but I had an interesting faculty. Most of them were adjunct, not all, but a lot were adjunct from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they taught between Cooper Union and Philadelphia.
Do you remember any of them in particular?
I remember all of them, yeah. Uh-huh. And what's very interesting that there's a show of Henry Finkelstein, a painter who's showing at John Davis right now.
Right.
His mother was my senior painting teacher. And I happened to be doing a painting indirectly about her when I found out he was showing in Hudson. So I found that was interesting. I don't know if she would approve of me painting on aluminum, so I didn't show him the painting.
Well, I can't imagine he was going to probably take you to task too severely.
Oh, she was just a very interesting woman. I mean, she only had to say a couple words, and I got exactly what she meant.
What she meant?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, saturation. I said, okay, I know what that means. But And also there was a strong connection to the Black Mountain College. My junior painting teacher was a fellow named Joseph Fiore, and he was the last painter that basically locked up Black Mountain College. He was a student. He stayed on, and then everybody had left, and I had him for teacher and so forth. Franz Klein was there right before I was there.
Oh, really?
So I didn't have him. Mm-hmm. But it was good for me. It was a good formal education, and it took me years to start knocking all those people off the shelf.
So when you say a good formal education, did you study anatomy and you did
drawing? No, that was not the whole formal thing was we were in a structural age. So I knew I learned a lot about say Cézanne, a lot of my mm-hmm. And I took material and techniques classes. I took a lot of, I considered art school to be three-pronged. One was art history. Second is what I called studio history, where some of your teachers were basically introducing other people's ideas. And the third was pure studio, where you could go out on a limb and fail. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was as much interested in. I seeing how far I could go, what it meant, but then still put it into a context and having the art history and what I called studio history to mesh together.
Tell me a little more about studio history.
Studio history is mostly what you get in art school. It's like your teachers have still kept heroes on the shelf.
Oh, it's sort of their version, their personal version.
Yeah. I don't want warmed over Cézanne. I want to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And this was the 1960s, or it's fine. Matisse is fine, but I could also see him as a slide, or I could hear it from the mouth of a teacher, or I could go to the museum and see the real thing. So I had three different versions of the same thing.
And so you were living in Philadelphia, or
I commuted. Yeah. I commuted because mm-hmm. I also probably up until I moved to Hudson, my average, I probably have about 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night since I was a teenager, because there's so many things going on.
Do you still do that?
What's that?
You still do that?
Not in Hudson. No, I've created my own time now. I can sleep on my time. but I also worked as I think I mentioned that somewhere when we had a conversation. I also worked as in a laboratory and.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I think that's
so.
So you found that art school was something that was. Let me rephrase that. This is a question. You found that art school was a place really to learn about how to produce art, and perhaps less what it's become.
I learned the importance of networking. I learned the importance of having one-to-one conversations with people. I found that very important. Like you and I are having a conversation, and it's just you and I. There's no one else in the world now except those interlopers that are listening to us. Mm-hmm. And I found that was good. As I said, I had to put wrongs on this ladder that we're missing a lot in the world, and I use that as a metaphor for... and as you got higher and higher, it became perhaps more interesting.
Mm-hmm. What kind of painting were you doing? Let me just go back again, actually. Have you always painted? Have you ever done sculpture and collage and that kind of thing?
Collage is part of it. I mean, that was one of the ABCs. That was the C, I guess, collage. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're dealing with Picasso space, if you're dealing with something, you're dealing with discontinuous space and not Renaissance space. And so that, but yeah, no, in terms of my own studio output, I was basically a figurative artist. Most of my teachers were figurative artists, whatever that means in a world that was, was coming out of abstract expressionism. At the same time, there was a lot of overlap. I mean,
what did figurative mean at that point?
At this, the point in Philadelphia, you had a model sitting in a studio, but I also had teachers and instructors, painters who were putting them into conversations. One figure talking to the other figure, so to speak, with maybe historical referencing.
So this was more sort of a narrative.
Yeah, but it was a formal narrative. I mean, if you have a model, it's going to be formal.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Philip Perlstein, a model in a studio. That's a formal arrangement that has to do with anything that you could talk about in terms of abstraction or figurative. Composition, color interaction. Those are all things that can become figurative, but they're also very abstract ideas of how things work together without having something like a pair of lips or a, mm-hmm. or a foot intervene.
Mm-hmm.
I quickly, after art school, got rid of the model and used real figures.
When you say you got rid of the model, you used real figures. I'm not quite sure I follow that one.
Follow your muse and you'll understand. I wanted them to be part of the experience of figures. People don't.
So at that
just,
point, you weren't working from a model.
I was working from a model, but there were people that I knew.
Okay.
Some were nude, some were not. And maybe they were combing their hair. Maybe they were doing something that was an everyday activity. Maybe they were doing something else, but they weren't just sitting there posing. They weren't posing for me, so to speak. And I took a lot of discretion on how I worked with them. And as time went on, by the 1980s, I simply was making everything up. And a lot of that was based on my own experiences, of which there's been many, many experiences in many, many ways, from working in and working here, or from seeing this, or from being in situations.
So while you were going to art school, then you were actually working in a chemical
It was a physical. It was a chemical lab and a physical lab, meaning that we worked with materials and chemists work with other things, and there was some overlap. But
so, how did you know enough about chemistry to do that?
Back in the 1950s, other countries were doing a lot more things with going, shooting rockets and all that. And I had a great high school background in both humanities and in the sciences. And when I got out of high school, I didn't know where the next rung was going to be. And it was working in a factory. And eventually.
Oh, so you did that before you went to art school?
And
while you were there?
Yeah, from 1959 to 1966, I was a full-time technician testing samples that were coming to me from production in the iron industry, in powdered metallurgy is what it was called.
Where was that where was that facility located?
That was in New Jersey. So I would finish art school at 5 and be in my position at 6 o'clock in New Jersey, in bed at 3 a.m. and up by 6, ready to go to art school the next day.
That's not the usual way of doing things.
I've never done anything usual.
Well, I know that, but it's not the usual way of people going to art school, I don't believe.
No.
I mean, that seems to me they tend to have, sort of art-related.
I paid my way on everything in life,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way, it worked out, and it was wonderful.
So do you think that experience, that experience of having basically two full-time jobs, sort of affected you in terms of how you see the world, and that it's not a frivolous place?
Yeah. If I had come home and sat in front of a TV, it would have affected me. But it gave me a bigger world view. People throw that term around. I mean, I worked for a Swedish company. I did field work in Pittsburgh, Allegheny Ludlum Steel Company. I was developing something with a company with my supervisor on cutting slag ends off of stainless steel. And we spent half the time in the museums because the Swedes are very much involved with the arts. And so we was Sven Branstad and myself simply would knock off early and go to the Carnegie Museum and have arguments about Giacometti. And that's, you know, so, and when I, sometime later, I said, well, I learned a little bit of Swedish. So I sat down on a Saturday afternoon with his kids and learned Swedish as they were learning to read Swedish themselves.
You know, I have to tell you something funny about that because it, long ago, I was in Philadelphia, and I was there with a client and something that I was working on. And, you know, it's got very boring. And I said to the guy, listen, you know, I have another appointment back in New York. We really got to hurry this up, and I got to get to the train station for the train. So we hurried it up. He took me to the train station. I went through the train station, out the other side. And how long a walk is it to the Philadelphia Museum?
Philadelphia Art Museum. I don't know, it must have been about a 20-minute walk.
Yeah, exactly.
I just walked out. Yeah, I've done that.
I just walked out the back door.
And, yeah.
And went in there and stayed. I'm trying to remember what it was I wanted to see in particular, but it wasn't open.
Oh, it wasn't open. I spent a long time actually drawing from both Cézanne and Renoir, of all people.
Yeah, that's a great...
it's a great museum.
I like that. So... you're out of art school, and you're painting and working at the same time, and in this metallurgical activity.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Gretna Campbell, the woman I was talking about, who was Henry Finkelstein's mother, who's showing here. Anyway, she kept pushing me to apply for a Fulbright when I was an undergraduate at Philadelphia, and I finally did, and I finally got one. So I think in August of 1966, I turned in my resignation at the factory, or at the company, and got on a boat, the Kongsholm, and sailed to Copenhagen. And came back. I was there a year. I spent a lot of time in France, in Paris, and in Copenhagen. And came back and decided whether I was going to go to graduate school and how that would benefit me. I still had the backup of being a metallurgical technician, which I used in New York for a while. That's another story. And decided either I was going to go to Indiana or I was going to go to Brooklyn College for an MFA, where there was a good faculty. And Indiana made the best deal. They gave me teaching assistantship. I also became the assistant registrar at the museum at Indiana, and I figured that was going to help me if I needed employment. I wasn't going to get it just being a painter. So I spent 2 years there, and after that, eventually, through this, that, and the other, started tenure track teaching.
So where was that?
All over the place. I usually got fired, but that's another.
Well, this is interesting because I remember you telling me you usually got fired.
It's probably the best recommendation anybody can have because
the people they don't fire are the ones they should fire.
It's just one of those things. You know, you have to follow. You have to. You know, you don't give up your soul for this, that, or the other. And I'm a little bit stubborn, but anyway, I was at a full-time teaching job in the Midwest. Uh-huh. Not Indiana. And
for a couple of years, and then...
It was 1 year.
One year?
I only lasted 1 year, and it had to do with the fact that it was the height of the Vietnam War. I just come back 3 years ago from Denmark, where I learned a lot about our country that I didn't learn here. So as my worldview got larger, young faculty decided that we would just take our students off campus for one day. I do that anyway. You go out and landscape paint. Well, if administration got wind of it and wanted to dock my salary for not having it where at the assignment. And I said, nah. So I was fired.
This happened a couple of times.
Yeah, because I have my own principles when I teach. In terms of what needs to be done.
Tell me what does need to be done.
You've got to introduce the students to something broader than just their discipline. You won't survive in the world. You've got to see the interconnections. I mean, if you're going to be part of the civilization, our civilization, any civilization, there's some things you just need to know about. I never taught with a textbook. I taught a lot of art history, a lot of contemporary things, and they were always my own point of view supplemented by other people's point of view.
Was this popular with the administration?
No.
It wasn't?
It depends on where you are. I mean, Indiana was great. We had a lot of activists on the faculty, Jim McGarrell, Bill Bailey, who simply were very outspoken in a very progressive administration. But you never know where you're going to wind up out of either necessity or because of something looks interesting, or you do it. But you still are your own person.
So ultimately, you went through a couple of those kind of jobs.
Oh, yes.
And then, so we don't have to repeat the process because we know what happened.
Yeah.
But then if I remember this correctly from what you told me, you ended up in West North Carolina?
Yeah, I also spent a few years in the city in Lower Manhattan. I was brought in to try to put together a structure for a figurative run museum.
So this was in between. Okay, I wanted to get into that because that's really interesting. Yeah, what happened?
Yeah. And then eventually I bounced down to North Carolina.
Well, let's go back to the museum, because that's the American Choice Artist Choice Museum.
The Artist Choice Museum. Yeah. It was one of those strange serendipitous growing things that grew out of some figurative co-ops in the 1960s that I attended, and then some co-op galleries were formed in Soho.
This is like
we're talking about 1967 into the 70s.
To remember the names of some of those co-ops. Weren't they on? There are two of them in one building, as I remember.
Yeah.
They shared a floor. Blue Mountain.
Blue Mountain. And Blue Mountain was interesting. Rudy Burkhardt asked me if I wanted to become part of that structure in 19. That was a later one in a sense. It was Green Mountain, and then a guy named Lucien Day was financing that. But Bowery was one gallery. It was started out in the Bowery. Prince Street and First Street, the three of those were the major ones.
Right.
And eventually in 75, 76, there was a huge exhibition that happened called Artist Choice. And from that point on, from 76 to 79, they decided that maybe having a real museum would be interesting. It didn't work for a couple of years, and then a couple of artists, Paul Georges being one of them, asked me if I would come in and try to put the pieces together. And I said, yeah, I'll do it for 1 year. I did. I stayed for 3 years, and then I went to North Carolina and took up a directorship of an art program.
But the museum actually it ended up having a...
You had a space
having a home, right?
It did. It started out in artist lofts and borrowed space. I mean, one of my jobs was to put together with some other people a series of visible exhibitions in uptown galleries. So we had every space from Marlborough to some that are no longer in existence, Fischbach, Frumpkin Gallery.
They gave us
visibility.
Uh-huh.
And I started a newsletter and then a journal that also helped the visibility, and we caught the attention of quite a few people.
Well, I think the idea there was that the true experts were artists, not the critics.
Yeah.
So you started out offending all the powers that be before you even tried to find a place to offend them.
Basically, the artists were the real board. The Board of Trustees, who were the money people, mm-hmm. and the people that had a lot of the contacts were a board of advisors. And it was fascinating. But my studio work came first. And that's why I told them up front it would be a limited.
Where were you living?
I had a loft on Water Street.
You're on Water Street.
Yeah.
So you were down, way down.
Yeah, it was an old wooden building that was owned by a sea captain. I was told it was a wreck, but it was beautiful.
Did you have a view of it? Because you see it.
No, they have Chase Manhattan Bank had their headquarters. So I think 15 minutes of the day I got sun, and once in a while if I looked right there I could see the Staten Island Ferry.
Oh, fine.
But it was still just beautiful and wonderful. I also, moonlighted at the University of Pennsylvania a couple of days a week, so I could afford to play a little bit.
So has what's happened from that time, which was perhaps the early 80s, to now, has it gotten worse in terms of the art market or the art market now, becoming institutionalized?
I've become younger.
You've become younger. Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, basically, what it means is I don't give a darn. Uh-huh. And basically, you know, I'm not in a position I want to jump up and make something to say, well, will this sell? Will that sell? I mean, I'm giving you a simplistic answer, George. Mm-hmm. In a way, my main thing is just to make things. I think it's always been complicated. Everybody's always grumbled, no matter what age it is. It's just what artists do, and what people should do. They should not be, you know. If you're happy, that's called entropy, and then you don't do anything.
Happiness is entropy. Okay. Well,
no, that's good to know. You can have you can have unconventional.
I knew I was going downhill, but I didn't know I was happy doing it.
Unconventional happiness is fine, but happiness every day is pretty static.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, I think that's true. You know, it's like anything else. I suppose too much of a bad thing is not good for you. Now you're in Nashville. You're not in Nashville. You're in Asheville.
I'm in Asheville. I'm in the mountains. That was 1985. I give it 5 to 7 years. I was brought in as a, again, like I was an artist's choice to make something work. I was hired, as I have in some positions, over, you know, the mainstream faculty's objections. I was hired by a dean, and I was giving 3 objections, and I had 2 years to do it. And that was to make the department visible, get rid of the dead wood, and grow the program. Some of those are easier than others.
Which was the easy one? I can't think of one that's very easy.
Growing a program is no problem. You know how you have to get visibility, and you have to use the networking.
The dead wood's the hardest to get rid of.
Hardest thing is to get rid of the dead wood, mm-hmm. because you've got a 10-year problem, and you just have to be vigilant about that. I was also able to double the enrollment within 2 years of the majors by changing some programs, by going out and talking, and by.
Do you have a sort of the touch or administrative abilities?
I didn't know that I did,
but I mean, you had to.
Well, I mean, you have to learn how to herd cats.
Well, that's administering cats and dead wood and cats.
And it's fine. It's just eventually you have to know also when to fold the tent. Mm-hmm. And sometimes mm-hmm. you wait too long, mm-hmm. and you have to go backwards. But no, I enjoyed it. I also, you know, wrote. I also did a lot of interviews, TV, radio. I also wrote a weekly column on the arts. I also was able to get NEA grants and stuff like that. And that's with help, you know, with somebody getting your back. You don't do mm-hmm. all that alone. And
so you could attract better faculty. And
I had what I called my shadow faculty. Most of the faculty are in a university, as you know, are on 9-month contracts. I told them that I would honor their 9-month contract, but I would not honor a 12-month contract that I was bringing in summer faculty from the outside. Import-export is very important at any university. I don't care if it's what it is. You've got to bring in other ideas. And in trade, I said, I will develop a traveling exhibition of your work, and I would tour it for 2 years around the country. And I got most of the agreement, but I did it. You know, I said, this is a fait accompli. You only have 9-month contracts. Summer school contracts are separate. It's run by a separate thing. That's my. And also, I changed some schedules. I had an alcoholic printmaker mm-hmm. who afternoon was shot. But they were always giving him, the previous people were giving him afternoon classes. I said, Bill, you're very good at 8 in the morning. How about I give you all morning classes? And I got more productivity out of him by doing that, but just trying to mm-hmm, get a bigger mm-hmm. picture.
So were you teaching at the same time?
Yeah, I was teaching. I had a reduced load. I was also coordinating a university gallery, and I had expectations that if things worked out, that they would owe me a new building. And I got it before I left. We got a $30 million
really?
Building and a museum, and I also had 2 governor's appointments on the State Arts Council Board and ran the visual and directed the visual arts section for the North Carolina Arts Council for half a dozen years.
And you stayed there for how long?
25 years.
Oh, you were there 25 years? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I came here in 2011, and so yeah.
I thought there were some other things in between.
I walked in one day, the faculty. I told them I'm resigning my department headship, and I stayed a few more years.
Mm-hmm.
So enough of the academics.
So basically, you retired from there.
I quit.
You quit.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good thing.
Artists never retire.
So you brought in, I guess one of the things that you were telling me that you brought in a bunch of very interesting visiting artists.
Yeah, I mean, there's ways of doing that. You use regional artists, you can use national artists, and once in a while I was able to bring in an international artist in all the fields. The faculty always had us, we had meetings. I listened to the faculty and what their needs were. And what my needs were, and it was a pretty doggone good thing. The administration that hired me morphed somewhat, but for about 16 of those years, and I was directed the program for 16 years, and I stayed a few more years, and then I had to decide what I was going to do. I didn't want to stay in the South after that,
mm-hmm.
but I had already pulled the tent.
Okay, well. Time really flies, because the stuff you've done is very diverse and very interesting, and how you got to where you got to is a mystery to me.
Hey,
but
look,
you seem to have done it. So
no,
you're
sitting
here.
You can't plan it, George. It just has. If you plan, you don't get anything done, and you have to be 2 seconds in the future. No more than 2 seconds in the future, otherwise you get bogged down. But if you're always planning. You're not doing anything.
You're not doing anything. Now this is true. This is true. I wanted to sort of get around to your work. What's the process? Where do your ideas come from? How do you do it? Do you start out with drawings?
I always, even when I was in art school, for some reason I decided. If I'm going to the museum and having to draw from a major Cézanne, then why can't I start out as a major Godfrey and draw from that? Mm-hmm. So I always start out basically with a major canvas. I always bit off.
When you say you start out with a major canvas,
in art school, that would be like a. Maybe a 4x6.
Oh, you're talking about size.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I did a lot of studies from that work, either drawings or things. So I've always worked that way, where I wanted to get over my head enough, 10% over my head or whatever you want to use, and then work myself out of something, whatever that was. And it had to be my own issues. And as I said, the muse is what drives me. And the muse has to do with the way you perceive things in terms of, like, for me, gesture, in terms of how things move, how things relate, how two or three people together work.
Okay. Tell me about gesture. Let me go back even further than that. Tell me, there's a certain point, I think, in art history where gesture became extremely important.
You can do gesture drawings. Right now, the way I'm looking at you, I can't see your eyes, but you're talking with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So that all becomes like a whole thing, a way a toe points. The way somebody gestures like that, you see it in Courbet, you see it in a lot of artists.
Oh, you're not talking about the actual gestural aspects of putting paint on a canvas.
I do that too, but not so much. I mean, I'm not a shoulder painter. I'm probably an elbow to wrist painter.
But how can that be with these big? You have, I was going to say canvases is not right. You have big pieces.
Oh yeah.
And they don't look like they're wrist paintings to me at all. They're quite sweeping.
Spray can helps me a lot.
Well, so the spray pan is. We can't tell you what we're looking at here, but I have a bunch of books that the Roberts put together over the years, and they certainly look to me like they're filled with gestures. Isn't that a big gesture?
Well, I lie too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
No. Some of the.
I mean, I can see the aspects that aren't gestural, but.
Okay. look at it this way. I'm a figure ground person. All of my space is on the surface. A lot of it now appears to be outer space. I've done a lot of paintings right before I moved here that have stars and moons in them. Yeah, I'll move some things around, George, and then basically when the background dries, I work the figure almost as drawing right now on top of it. But in terms of knowing a figure.
Well, do you start out with an idea?
I start out with messing around. Sometimes I wake up.
Okay, I spent the morning messing around.
Yeah, and what did you do?
Well, I ended up finding a whole bunch of cutout pieces of paintings I'd done on paper, and I started reassembling them.
All right. Well, that's messing around.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So why? So, I mean, you're either messing around physically looking at stuff, or it's in your head.
Yeah, you know, it's like putting words together. Like, you know, John Ashbery's mentioned that about, you know, he doesn't know what a poem is, but he's messing around. And when I was fairly close friends last years of his life with Kenneth Nolan, mm-hmm. who was from Asheville and all that, and spent a lot of time in his studio in North Bennington before he moved to Maine, his last studio. And he always talked about, you know, he was fooling around, he was mm-hmm. messing around. You have sort of an idea, and then as it's developed, you have to be confident enough that you can change as you go along, like our conversation. Mm-hmm. Oops, we go in one direction. Oops, right. We go in another direction, and hopefully we've come out with something that has some sort of cohesion with it.
Well, they haven't cut us off yet. So I guess maybe there's hope here. Finally, you know, when you mentioned gesture and Ashbery, sort of in the same John Ashbery, in the same breath, it occurs to me, you know, because his The way I understand him to write, right? What I mean, that's not correct. What I understand his poems to be is a series of not necessarily related descriptions of something or other, and one could almost call those gestures.
That's a good way. Yeah, I can accept that. Yeah,
that's good. He puts his gestures out, and he does another gesture, and he comes back, and he comes back, and instead of correcting his first gesture or his first line, he'll say the opposite four lines below.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's different than, say, if you do an equivalent, someone who I respect and know fairly well is Philip Perlstein. He knows when he starts at point B, A, that where he's going to be when he ends at point Z. Mm-hmm. And it's very methodical, and a number of my teachers were that way. And some people think that Ken Nolan was that way, and to a degree he wasn't. But there was enough little wiggle room for him in terms of messing around mm-hmm. that I can see it.
Okay, we're rapidly running out of time, which is unfortunate because there's a whole bunch of things I really wanted to talk to you about. One of them is your activities as a gallery.
That's all Elwood Beach.
Okay, so tell me about your galleries.
It's something that I never thought about, but as I said, I did sort of work in Indiana University in their museum as a graduate student, and worked with someone named Sarah Whitfield, who was very young like myself. Her husband at the time was teaching at IU, and we had a good time just talking about what we would do. And she became a very important gallerist and curator in Britain. And in fact, she and David Sylvester did the definitive Magritte book together.
Oh, really?
And I'm thinking, I had no contact with her since 1968 or 69, and I often wondered whatever happened to Sarah. Well, so we had discussions. So from that point on, I was sort of bitten with organizing shows, curating shows, putting things together, and it ended up as a gallerist, as Robert, the gallerist, in Hudson, New York, in 2012 to 2015, I think, I ran something called the Curatorium without my name, used a lot of guest curators, and I just wanted them to do things that you wouldn't normally see in a gallery. You can get into sort of a rut as an artist and as a gallerist. You put things on the wall in the way that Whistler did it in Britain, I don't know how many hundreds of years ago, and then all of a sudden it gets to be routine. It gets to be like, so I wanted something to outside of the studio to keep me sort of like amused, and working with galleries or quasi galleries or faux galleries, whatever you want to call them, as the Curatorium was, as a duration piece. I knew it was going to end. I do that. And
are you still doing it?
No, I not at all.
You want to do it again?
No,
you're done.
That was something that I would have liked to have introduced in my overall plan for the new museum that I designed down in North Carolina. As I said, I quit, went in a different direction. So the Curatorium was sort of like, aha, I know I can do it.
Now, you also, and I have a whole bunch of these, of the books that Robert puts together, which are incredible. They're gorgeous looking, and they have some very interesting texts. And if we have time, I want to get into the text. But
sure.
Did you start doing these books after you stopped being a curator?
No, I started doing these books 10 years ago when I first got a... I think that's about the time the iPhone started coming out, and also working.
By the way, are these available in here? No.
No. They're just another grin for me in a certain way. Mm-hmm. They're desktop, which I approve of because if I deal with editors, things are going to be changed, and I have a long fuse. But at the same time, it's a way of figuring out things and messing around. I use my collaborator, as you know, is mentioned as Elwood Beach, and everybody said, "Well, who is Elwood Beach?" And do you want to know?
Elwood Beach seems to be an Irishman, from what I can make out.
Yeah, and Elwood Beach sort of works as on many levels. I often look back at someone like a Marianne Evans and say, "Well, she could never exist without George Eliot." She would have never written the books. And then I look at Ivan Karp, who had a gallery. And I said, well, Ivan Karp could have never existed without O.K. Harris. If you talk to Ivan Karp and you want to be in the gallery, he said, I have to O.K. it with Harris.
O.K. with Harris.
So O.K. Harris. So one can use those.
This is like the car salesman. You know, I got to check this with the credit manager. Routine,
but you know, it's playful, and it has a very good tradition in terms of not only the arts but in literature, and I find it fascinating. I was very just little things. I like the fact that that Molly Bloom has a sculpture of herself in Gibraltar, and I'm thinking, yeah, Molly Bloom is a.
Molly Bloom has a sculpture of herself in Gibraltar?
Yes, did you know that? That's where she, in the book, was born.
I know, that's the Spanish, under the Spanish wall, where the yes comes from.
Well, that's where there is an actual sculpture.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So it's all...
That's worth a trip.
It's playful, and it's like, you know, you've got to laugh at yourself.
Does she still have the old handkerchief?
I haven't seen it in person. I've only seen a repro of it, George.
Oh, my God. So do you write? I think you do, because
I have been a member of the International Association of Art Critics. I've written hundreds and hundreds of published articles on the arts under Robert Godfrey. I was the major art critic for the Asheville Citizen Times and wrote 200 Sunday articles, and then said, that's enough. And so forth, but I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that now. I turned all that over to Elwood Beach, and once in a while, an artist. I was asked to send, I want to see some slides, I've seen your work, send me some, and all of a sudden Elwood Beach would decide to write a poem or a faux poem or give a critique, and all of a sudden in the mail they'll get a half a dozen of the Scion publications without saying, where the heck did these come from?
Well, now, how busy is Elwood Beach?
Oh, I sleep in shifts. I sleep from about 7 at night.
Not you, but Elwood Beach.
Well, he informs me about 2 hours every night. He's very active.
I see. Okay. But he's a busy busy writer still.
Yes. Yes.
He's still writing reviews?
No, he is not. He only deals with the Scion publications, and mm-hmm. when Curatorium was there, he was the executive producer and did all the signage on the walls.
Mm-hmm. You know, when it must have been 2 weeks ago, I guess, when we got together, and we were talking a little bit about this concept of an unreliable narrator. And I wondered if you'd had any further thoughts on that issue.
No, we should always be kept off balance in some way. So mm-hmm. so anything that's slightly unreliable is fine with me.
Okay. We are getting down very close to the end, so I think what I need to do is to thank you very much for coming in on this beautiful day, when you could, in fact, be out behind your apartment in Hudson tending your, what do they call, heritage tomatoes?
Heirloom tomatoes. Yes, the brandy wines are still producing after all these 90-day,
Now, what do you do with them all? Do you cook them up? And
oh, yeah, I use them in any salads. I also distribute them to people that know me. I mean, I've got there's a great fellow named Jason who works at CVS, and all of a sudden a bag will arrive of great tomatoes for him.
So this is how you, when you get frustrated with dealing with Elwood Beach and dealing with your paintings, you go out and take care of your tomatoes?
Well, I mean, I still have the farmer thing in me, so to speak.
Did you actually, you worked on this farm,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, I learned to drive
so
on a John Deere.
So this is full circle.
Yeah. No, I learned to drive on a John Deere tractor and a pickup, and I also knew how to drive a mule. We had Dick and Jenny, the mules, still when I was growing up.
That's amazing. Now, something like 30 seconds. So I'm going to ask you a 25-second question. Is figuration in some way or other always going to be with us, or is it going to go away?
It will change, but it'll always be with us, just like the written word will always be with us, so will images.
And it's not going to go away. Abstraction.
Well, if we go away as a civilization, it might, or as a country, but we won't go there. No, as long as
okay,
we're here.
Now I think we're done. We have 1 second.
No.
Thank you.